Welcome to Trinity Forum Conversations. I'm Cherie Harder, the president of the Trinity Forum, and with me today is Dr. Michael Lindsay. Michael is an award-winning sociologist, author, and educator who serves as president of Gordon College, located outside of Boston, Massachusetts. His works include Faith in the Halls of Power, a Pulitzer Prize-nominated book that was listed in Publishers Weekly as one of the best books of 2007, and has been profiled in hundreds of media outlets worldwide. His newest book, View from the Top, an inside look at how people in power see and shape the world, published by Wiley and Rhine, is a fascinating look at the essential characteristics of leaders, which is drawn from his work on the largest ever interview-based analysis of senior organizational leaders, which we've invited him here today to discuss. Michael, great to have you here.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.
Now, you seem to be fascinated by leadership. Now, was there a particular experience that made you attached to this issue?
You know, I think that a lot of the research that we do as scholars emerges out of some of our own biography. My dad was a business leader in the golf business. He served as president for PGA of America. And when I was growing up, he would travel 180, 200 nights a year. So he was constantly on the road. So I think even as a young man, I was interested in the kind of lifestyle of folks who have institutional responsibility. I was able to see up close the good, the bad, the ugly of that kind of lifestyle. And then also see a slightly different variation in the life of my mom. She started as a teacher at a prep school in my hometown of Jackson, Mississippi, moved up through the ranks and ended up serving as junior high principal at that school. And she just retired as head of school after being there for 10 years as head and being on the faculty for 40 years. So both of their lives and their experiences, I think, really shaped my interest in leadership.
In researching this book, it looks like you've interviewed hundreds of leaders. I think you told me 550 leaders. What leadership trait that you teased out from your research surprised you the most?
I think I did not have a good understanding of how much of leadership happens below the radar. In the book, I refer to it as the iceberg effect of leading, which is to say most leaders spend their time doing one of two things, either keeping bad things from becoming public or working on good things that don't materialize. And they don't announce, I've been working for the last 3 months on a merger that just fell through. They just go about their daily business. So I was surprised at how much energy, time, resources are devoted to these things that are far away from the limelight, but really occupy a majority of the time that leaders are invested in. It also gave me a deeper sympathy for the challenges of leading, because so often the leader is having to manage their own emotions when they know information or they anticipate the next step, and they're several points ahead of their followers. That can be really challenging. One very poignant example is that the night that our special forces went to apprehend Osama bin Laden was also the night of the White House Correspondents' Dinner here in Washington. So you've got the President of the United States, who has just ordered an attack on America's enemy number one, and he's also needing to give jokes before a group of White House correspondents. That's the challenge of leading. You always are a couple of steps ahead of your followers, and so it requires you to manage not just the emotions of the organization, but your own emotion. You're in a different place.
In your book, you asserted that a key time for an emerging leader, what you call a proto-leader, is their 20s, that this is really where leadership traits get developed or not. Hmm. What advice would you give to a gifted, bright 20-something who comes out of college but is struggling to find work, struggling to develop their own capabilities, but would like to be a leader?
So I'm a big believer in a life of prayer, and I do think that we ought to pray about next opportunities. And I think God can be faithful to open up those kinds of opportunities. I think it's also important to begin to cast a wide net of contacts. What we found in the research is something that a sociologist named Mark Granovetter found in the 1970s called the strength of weak ties. We actually don't get jobs or opportunities because it's close family and friends who connected us, but it's usually a friend of a friend or acquaintance networks. So I always encourage, you know, the Gordon students who are graduating, tell everybody you know and tell them to tell their friends you're looking for a job in this city or you're trying to get an opportunity. I'm a big believer in things like the Trinity Forum Academy, which provide good opportunities for both faith formation, vocational discernment, and some real life professional experience. I think that those are all important ways in which young people begin to get their footing. One of the most important things that we learn in the course of this research is that there's no statistically significant relationship between most of the attributes of your youth and long-term success. So it doesn't matter if you came from a wealthy family or from a poor family. It doesn't matter if you went to an Ivy League school or a no-name school. It doesn't matter if you were captain of the football team or a terrible athlete. Those things don't matter over the long haul of whether you'll be successful as a leader or not. What does matter are the mentors that are in your life. Those can develop through church, through Boy Scouts, through athletics, coaches, teachers. But it's very important for young people to seek out more seasoned leaders who will help them navigate the waters. One of the key things we found is that formal mentoring programs, where a company says we have 20 executives and we're going to pair them up with 20 young professionals, that actually doesn't work. Formal mentoring programs really don't meet the needs of either the mentor or the protege. What does work is creating an ecosystem out of which relationships between more senior and more junior leaders can develop organically. That's one of the most important things. So I tell young people they need to find the kinds of people they would like to be like and then to develop acquaintance relationships so that they can get into those networks.
Did you have mentors in your life?
I did. A number of them. I would not be serving as a president at Gordon College if it were not for three people who made a very significant impact in my life. One was a man named Bill Townsend, who was married to my youth minister in Jackson, Mississippi, who is now serving as a vice president for advancement at Mississippi College. He had been in Christian higher education and really helped me to see a way in which my academic interest and vocational interest might have a pathway in higher education. A second person is Gary Cook, who is the current president of Dallas Baptist University. He's the longest serving president of any of the Council for Christian College and University presidents today. He's been in the job for 25 years. And then the third person was George Gallup, one of the namesakes for the Gallup poll. And I worked for George for a number of years, worked on a couple of book projects, and he was a real mentor in my life.
One of the intriguing assertions of your book is your contention that a liberal arts approach to life is an essential aspect of effective leadership. Unpack this a little bit for us. What is a liberal arts approach to life, and who do you think models it well?
So this is probably one thing I did not expect in the research, but we found 73% of the people that I interviewed actually majored in a liberal arts field as undergraduates. And if you look at those folks who rise to the most senior positions in organizations, they have an innate talent that is able to build connections across lots of different domains. They're great conversationalists. You take them to a dinner party, and they can get along with virtually anybody. So they can talk archaeology with a bookish person. They can talk sports with a jock. They can build relationships with people around popular culture, the arts, entertainment, literature, history. They're polyglots. And they're not polyglot in the sense that they're trying to prove their knowledge base, but they are relational entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. And they realize to be building relationships, you have to find a point of connection. That's why I would say virtually every person who runs for president of the United States, if they make it through the primary season, they've already demonstrated they've got that liberal arts approach to life. They can build relationships at 10 o'clock with dock workers over coffee and have lunch with nuclear physicists at 12 noon. You have to be able to calibrate according to these different ways of thinking, and that you have to be able to connect with lots of different people. We did find that sports was the number one way of building relationships in our culture. So it makes a huge difference whether you're a man or a woman. Doesn't matter if you're a CEO or a lower-level manager, sports becomes the lingua franca of building relationships in our culture.
And why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's because it's pervasive. It doesn't have the same class or educational bias that we see in other fields. There's a French sociologist named Pierre Bourdieu, and he made the contention that in French society, you had to be exposed to high class, high culture. You needed to know the opera, museums. In the U.S., it's more about being a cultural omnivore, being able to talk lots of different things, and sports bridges all those divides.
view from the topic repeatedly asserts the importance of institutions, which is interesting given that most of your research was done with individuals and seems to be in many ways quite countercultural because a lot of technology has flattened institutions and even overturned industries. Why do you think the institution is so important?
So I interviewed 550 people who are arguably some of the most powerful people alive. They control the workplace environments for literally millions of people. And as I talked with these individuals and got a sense for what they were able to do in their jobs, they feel enormously constrained. Mike Duke, the CEO of Walmart, basically spent 20 minutes trying to show me how little room he had to innovate or to make things happen. And I said, look, you're the largest private employer in the country. You've got some real power. And he said, well, it's the various stakeholders. The institution is so much bigger than the individual. And I think that's what's happened. Whereas maybe 100 years ago, 150 years ago, individuals had tremendous influence. Our institutions were much more local. They were much smaller. There were not many layers, and they didn't have the span of control. The 20th century has been an entire era in which institutions have gotten bigger, they've usurped more control, and they're now all consuming, so that the individual who's at the top has actually very little room to navigate. Now, if you turn a ship like Walmart, it can have profound impact. And so part of the goal of View from the Top is to show there are very strategic roles that people in leadership can really occupy and can make a significant difference. But over the long haul, I've become convinced, and I didn't enter into this project expecting it, but I've become convinced institutions really are the things that wield the power. And individuals can have a role in shaping that, but it is relatively circumscribed.
Do you think institutions are more important than networks?
Networks become calcified into institutions. And networks can bring institutions together. Networks, however, don't have the permanence that institutions have. And I would say that most people who do formal network analysis in social science today would point to the ways in which institutions now are the most important nodes within networks, not individuals.
In the process of interviewing these 550 leaders, you were inevitably exposed to some very colorful personalities, as well as some incredibly impressive people. Who impressed you the most and why?
The book concludes with the story of Mike Ullman, who, in my opinion, is certainly one of the most impressive individuals I've ever met. Mike, in many ways, is an ordinary average guy. Wasn't a star student in college. He has some learning challenges, and so his reading comprehension never has been all that great. He has a degenerative spinal condition, which makes walking difficult for him. So he has a lot of challenge and hardship in his life. At the same time, Mike probably embodies the kind of virtuous leadership that I certainly aspire to in my own life. I had a chance to see him up close in a number of different settings. First, in 2004, when he was being recruited by Vernon Jordan, who was chairman of the board of JCPenney, to come and be the CEO. Then I followed his career while he was there for 7 or 8 years, retired as CEO in early 2012, handed over the reins to a guy named Ron Johnson, who was a Silicon Valley dynamo. He had built the retail business for Apple and came to JCPenney, and there was lots of excitement and enthusiasm for his leadership. Unfortunately, his style was to make some radical changes without enough market research. He ended up alienating the entire customer base of JCPenney and recruiting very few new customers, and as a result, the company lost $1 billion in a matter of 11 months. The board ended up making a transition, and they brought Mike back as the CEO. Mike embodies so many of the characteristics that I think make leaders great, but probably chief among them is a deep, real sense of love for the people he works with. He went back to Penny at a time when he didn't need to. Financially, he was secure. In fact, he was willing to do it for a dollar. And he really wanted to try and serve an institution that he believed in. So he impressed me. I should say, I had a chance to meet some extraordinarily amazing individuals on a whole range of different issues. But Mike is special.
One of the challenges of leadership that your book wrestles with is that the time demands placed on a leader can easily crowd out other obligations and relationships, including the needs of one's own spouse and family. What lessons did you take away in terms of navigating the demands of leadership, along with meeting the needs of and investing in your spouse and your family?
You know, I conducted an interview and was asking a question, and the person began to cry. When that happened, I immediately thought, you know, they don't teach you what to do in grad school when the person starts weeping. I didn't know if I was supposed to turn the recorder off or what was I supposed to do. It happened a second time. It happened a third time. Literally, I had hundreds of people cried at some point in time in the interview. I began to analyze, what is it that's drawing this point of deep introspection? And it usually occurred around one question. Has your professional success ever cost you something personally? And something about the way that question was worded and the timing in which it occurred in the interview, people were willing to open up and reflect on deep pain that was real in their life. It almost always involved work-life balance issues.
Was there a gender divide in that response?
Oh, both men and women would talk a lot about the challenge of rearing children when you have a very, very busy professional life. But the women, to a person, were always more anguished than the men. Women felt tremendous turmoil over if they had made a mistake, were they doing the right thing? I remember Karen Hughes, who had worked in the White House and had never really planned on being in the inner circle of political power, but that's where she found herself. And for her, you know, her faith is very important to her, and in many ways she felt called to the work she was doing in the White House. At the same time, her teenage son was struggling in Washington, and she decided that in the best interest of her family, she would resign her position and move back to Austin. And at the time I conducted the interview, that's where she was. And she was really wondering, am I missing my big opportunity? I'm personal friends with the President of the United States who has asked me to come and serve. This is my moment. Am I making a mistake? If you know her story, you know she went back to Washington, worked in the State Department for a couple years after her son went off to college. That wrestling that Karen Hughes talked about, I found to be almost always the case among the women I interviewed, and the case also among many of the men I interviewed. Work-life balance is really tough.
You started this study, which you call the Platinum Study, over 10 years ago. And about halfway through, you received an offer, which you accepted, to become the president of Gordon College, moving from this being an academic point of interest to being a very practical one. What lessons did you adopt as a result of your research into your leadership of Gordon?
So the funniest story is that when I went to go to Boston for the interview for the job at Gordon, that morning I was interviewing with the search committee, and that afternoon I was doing a research interview with Diana Chapman Walsh, the president of Wellesley College. And in the intervening time, the search committee met and decided that they would recommend me to the Board of Trustees. So literally, as I'm on the subway, the T in Boston, out to Diana's house, I get the phone call from the search consultant. His name is Price Harding, and Price,
we know him here.
Yes, he's a good man. Price said, Michael, you got the job. And I suddenly had a different agenda for this interview. And so if you look at my interview with Diana Chapman Walsh, I'm asking her all these questions about the first 90 days. And what did you do? You know, what were you thinking about? And it was only after the fact that I was announced that she wrote to me and said, now I know what you're talking about in that interview. So yeah, I started to try and pick up a lot of very practical lessons. Indeed, I spent about 6 weeks rereading every interview I had done to see if I could learn how to manage information, how to organize my office, how to figure out my own life. And still to this day, I think I've benefited greatly from the lessons I picked up from the folks I interviewed.
There's a somewhat startling chapter of your book in which you interviewed a number of C-suite leaders who, when asked about their high bonuses and compensation, even when their companies were contracting, expressed a sense of helplessness about their pay as if they couldn't do anything about it. Is there a leadership disconnect going on? Why would proactive and innovative executives assert they have no control over their own compensation at their own company?
This was probably the most disconcerting finding in my research, because many of the people that I interviewed I respect a great deal and had a lot of confidence in. And then when we would discuss the topic of executive compensation, it was as if they had relegated all responsibility and wanted somehow to feel like they were a victim of this system. One person I interviewed, who I won't name, said, I don't even know how much money I make. I said, well, that's because you make so much of it. You don't even realize there are people who really struggle. I mean, it turned out that particular individual had made $37.2 million the year before. I knew that because everybody else knew it. It was public record. I think that the challenge with executives is that you get so busy and the lifestyle is so consuming that it's easy to lose touch with regular life. It was the issue George H.W. Bush faced when he couldn't tell you how much a gallon of milk cost because he hadn't gone to the grocery store in years. It's the same effect. Executives can live in a rarefied world where they lose touch with reality. And so I think it's vitally important, if you're in leadership, to think about how much your lifestyle represents your leadership style. And it's very important for leaders and for the boards that support, encourage, and oversee them to be thinking about how does the leader's lifestyle represent the values of the institution.
As the leader of a preeminent Christian institution, you've established several different leadership programs there, and I'm sure have wrestled with the thought that Christ often worked through the weak rather than the strong, the dispossessed rather than the connected and resourced. How do you think Christianly about what leadership is and how it should be practiced?
So this research project was about 10 years in the making. And probably about year two, I had a crisis of faith because I realized that I was spending all this time and energy thinking about the people in power. And when you begin thinking about power, power can have a seductive influence on your life. And I would find that I discounted comments from some people because I didn't think that they were maybe smart enough, or I responded more proactively because I thought somebody would create more opportunities for me. I began to really not like myself and how I was responding to being in the presence of these individuals. And that led me to think about, you know, how should I as a Christ follower think appropriately about the use of power and ambition as well? I actually became despondent for a month or so because I thought I was spending all this time doing something that really was maybe not of God, and I didn't like that about myself. I then came upon a little work that John Stott had written where he talked about godly ambition and spoke about how it is possible for Christians who have been given really from birth, part of their DNA is entrepreneurial, forward-thinking, aspiring, ambitious. That's who they are. For them to deny that is to sort of not be who they were. And that there are many examples in the Bible of how God had used individuals in key positions who were ambitious in one way or another, but they also had spiritual disciplines that kept them grounded. I recognize that as you look at the Gospels and see how does Jesus respond to power, it's very interesting. He's certainly not entranced by worldly power. He's not seeking it out. He's very comfortable with the poor and lowly. But it's also striking to me that not once did Jesus speak ill about the secular authorities. I mean, the harshest things that he says about the Romans is, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's. And his disciples were begging him to renounce power and authority. And he didn't do it. Why not? I think if you look at the New Testament and take a fuller understanding of how the gospel spread, there's clear evidence that God can use individuals who are in powerful positions if they are willing to use their power for godly good and to have systems of accountability that keep them from what the Bible refers to as self-deception. That's probably the biggest challenge for folks who are in leadership. The Bible says we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. That's true for all of us. When you're in a leadership position, however, you have fewer people who are willing to speak truth to power. So you have to have a spouse who is not impressed with you, who's willing to tell you exactly how it is. Accountability group, friends who will say, you know, this is not really who you want to be. That requires deep friendship, but I found that there are some wonderful examples of folks who have built that into their life. I think that the noblest use of power is when it is put in service of those who do not have as much. That, in my opinion, is what Jesus would have us to do when we think about using worldly power for the common good.
Your book concludes with a discussion of what you call incarnational leadership, and you hold this out as really a source of hope. What is incarnational leadership, and why do you think it's so important?
In the book, we refer to it as leading with your life, that so much of what you pass on as a leader has little to do with strategy or with profitability or even growth. It really has to do with relationships. If I track the lives of these 550 people, what is it that they leave behind that is the most powerful legacy? It's not even the institutions, it's the relationships that were furthered by those institutions. Incarnational leadership is certainly resonant with the gospel, with the model of Jesus. It involves being personally invested in the lives of other people. It's also being intentional about saying, I want to make sure I'm spending time investing in relationships. So one of the bits of advice I give when a CEO asks me, what can I do most effective for my leadership? I say, you should make sure that you're always sponsoring a younger leader. Sponsorship's different than mentorship. Mentorship is more of a, let me help you along the way and answer your questions that you might have. Sponsorship is where the senior leader is taking the initiative, creating opportunity for the next generation. It's saying, I think you would be great as an aspiring filmmaker, and I'm going to introduce you to somebody in Hollywood that I happen to know. It, in my opinion, is the way that we make the biggest impact in the lives of young people, and that's what I think we're getting at when we talk about incarnational leadership.
Terrific. Thank you, Michael. You've been listening to an interview with sociologist, author, and Gordon College president Michael Lindsay, the author of View from the Top. Our mission at the Trinity Forum is to provide a space and resources for leaders to engage life's biggest questions in the context of faith, and to provide a platform for the best of Christian thought leadership through publications and programs such as this conversation. As a member of the Trinity Forum Society, you are a vital part of realizing that mission, and we offer this podcast interview as both a benefit of membership and in gratitude for your involvement. Thank you for joining us.